It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site, the links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too.
My new 15-minute story and opinion show, John Mack's Radio Rants, may also be accessed by going to my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com, and clicking the John Mack Radio Rants tab for an index of shows. And until recently, this show has had no regular schedule, but has been produced weekly. It will soon receive the regular time slot. My guest next week on the show is Putnam Valley Town Supervisor and potential candidate for Putnam County District Attorney, Bob Tendy. I hope you'll join us then. My guest tonight is writer, editor, technology pundit, and venture capitalist Stuart Alsop. I first met Stuart about 30 years ago at a technology conference hosted by Ben Rosen, who had been the electronics analyst at Morgan Stanley when I was responsible for its computer area. Stuart and I continued to run into each other at subsequent Rosen conferences and successor ones hosted by Esther Dyson. He was then my editor at InfoWorld magazine, and later I had him as the speaker at the New York IBM user group, where he spoke to about 250 people. Since those halcyon days of personal computing, Stuart has moved from writing to the field of venture capital, the field not often understood by those not involved in the process. We'll cover all of these topics tonight with Stuart Alsop, starting right now. Good evening, Stuart, and welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Thank you very much.
Let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., which actually makes me somewhat unusual, although more and more over the last now more than 60 years, there are more and more people that actually live in Washington, D.C., as opposed to show up for 4 years or so at a time. But my father was a political journalist, so I actually was born and raised and went to school in D.C., went to private schools until I went to boarding school at the age of 12, and followed a classic what the British refer to as a public school education, but is actually private. And then I went to school at Occidental College in Los Angeles, where I graduated from and never looked back. Not been in a classroom since.
Now, I know that your father, Stuart, was a political columnist, as was your uncle, Joseph. Did this environment point you toward writing at an early age or point you away from it?
I'd have to say that it had some effect. I've never sort of distanced myself. You know, some people that have a famous father prefer to, you know, separate themselves and try to establish themselves on their own, and I've always used it as much as I could for my benefit. But, you know, what I ended up doing essentially was what my dad ended up doing, although he did it in the world of international politics. And I ended up doing it in the world of international technology, which is political as well.
I remember one time that you didn't use it. You and I were standing at a Rosen conference talking when Jerry Brown was there. And you mentioned to me that you had a picture of your father with Jerry's father, Pat Brown. And I encourage you to go get a picture with Jerry. I thought that would be a nice offset to your father's picture, and you were reluctant to do it. I felt you were shy about it.
Yeah, that was pretty early on, too, because Ben, really Esther's conference, because the first one I went to was the one that Esther took over from Ben. I still was not, in my mind, well-established in my career, and so I didn't think of myself as a political guy and wanted to stip on that domain. I've gotten better at it more recently, though, and Jerry remembers me because, now he's the very successful governor of California again, although he wasn't particularly successful back then.
What did you major in at Occidental?
I was an English major. John, you're inclined to make me sound like I started out thinking I'd be doing one thing and, sort of follow my father's footsteps and then discover career. But I really had no idea what I was doing when I was in college. So English sounded like the easiest thing to do because you'd sit around and read novels and talk about them. So I managed to graduate without putting a lot of effort into it. But I do have a bachelor's degree in English.
Yeah, I was an English major too, and then I went bad and I got into technology. I was extremely lucky, and it was only through being in the right place at the right time.
Exactly.
In your note to me, you mentioned bartending school. Did you ever get to use it commercially?
So I graduated from Occidental, and I had a job actually at a newspaper. It was the newspaper in Pasadena, State of California, but it paid me $50 a week, so it clearly wasn't a career. So I decided to get married and move back to Boston. So I moved back to Boston with one sort of crappy journalism job. It was 1975, not a particularly easy time to find a job because the economy wasn't doing very well at that time, particularly a journalism job, which is kind of true at all times. So I thought to myself, well, if I go to bartending school, I can always get a job as a bartender because people drink all the time. Either that was not true or I was not a very good bartender. So I went all the way through bartending school, and the only job I could get was the service bar in a restaurant. A service bar is the one the waiters use to get drinks, which means you don't get any of the tips, and the waiters treat you like, the worst. So I lasted all of 3 days before I just quit in frustration.
The funny thing about that when I saw the note was before my son's a TV writer and a producer in Hollywood, but before he went out there, he asked me if I knew anyone that would teach him how to be a bartender. So I called this woman that owns a bar in my old neighborhood, and he wound up being the weekend bartender for the summer before he packed his bags, going off to Hollywood.
Always,
now.
Always a skill to have.
Yeah, now thankfully he never had to use it. Who are you? Who did you write for on the coast? And then what was your first writing job back in Boston?
Yeah, so the weekly newspaper is called the Pasadena Guardian, and it was started. You probably have the advantage to be able to remember this, but one of the co-founders, there were two guys that started it. One of whom had been a writer or editor, I'm not sure, at the Real Paper in Boston. The other of whom had worked at the Pasadena Star News. So they got together thinking that they could change Pasadena, and I can spend a lot of time on that, but Pasadena is basically a suburb of Los Angeles that struggles to be considered a real town itself. So they felt that the city of Pasadena, the people there would support the existence of a weekly alternative newspaper, because Pasadena had a daily newspaper, a five-day-a-week newspaper called the Pasadena Star News, which I think is still published. I'm not positive about that. So they started this while I was in my last year at Occidental, and Occidental is physically located right next to Pasadena. A friend of mine told me about it, so I went and started working there. That was a whole lot more interesting than going to school. At first I worked for free, and then I persuaded them to pay me all of $50 a week. But I did everything. I learned how to do pasteboards, and I didn't learn typesetting until later. But I would paste up pages. I'd take it to the printer and see how the printer did it. I'd take copies off the presses.
that go around to the distribution to the newsstands and put them in the newsstands. And then I'd also go out and write stories and take pictures. And I ended up being the architecture writer because Pasadena has brothers who are famous in architecture called Green and Green. But Frank Lloyd Wright also designed and built several houses in Pasadena.
Oh, wow.
And, so that was a lot of fun.
And then who did you, after you didn't bartend, who was your, what was your first writing job in Boston?
Yeah. So I got a job as a writer before I got a job as a bartender. So, and it was a really, this is how kids these days just don't understand what we had to go through. So I got a job in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is about 50 miles west of Boston on the Mass Turnpike. And I, you know, an old, aging industrial city that really had no hope going forward. And there was this business called the Small Business Service Bureau, which had a monthly broadsheet. Hard to hesitate to call it a magazine. And I was hired by the editor, who was working on by herself, and they allowed her to hire a second editor, and that was me. And she was willing to roll the dice on somebody that had no experience. Because she didn't, I think I was paid maybe $30,000 a year, which even then was not that much, or maybe even less. So, and you know, I did everything. Again, I did typesetting. They actually had a Conti graphic typesetter, so I learned how to replace the wheels, and I typed the stories and laid them out, did the paste up, took it to the printer, did all the same things, and wrote stories. And that was when I first learned about magazines. Magazines, I fell in love with magazines. And so that was a small business reporter, and eventually she left and I took over. I was the editor. I renamed it Small Business Magazine, and I was the sole editor. And then I finally got a real job. That was the marker in my life when I was hired as the an associate editor at a new magazine called Marine Business, which was started as the third in a triumvirate of magazines published by Bernie Goldhirsch, who ultimately was the founder of Inc. magazine, but at the time had started Sail. Sail was one of the very first special interest magazines. And then he started a magazine called Motorboat, and then he started a magazine called Marine Business. So he had one for sailors, one for powerboaters, and one for boat dealers. And I was hired as an associate editor at the Boat Dealer magazine. And this gets a little sketchy, and tell me if I'm going on too long, just feel free to interrupt. But I remember that I think it was, when was the first oil crisis? Was it 1977 or 79?
It was during the Carter years, and it was anywhere from 77 to maybe late 78 or early 79, because if you remember, he gave that speech that people got so upset with, telling us to cut down on our consumption.
Yeah, the misery index is what I remember. Misery index was Jimmy Carter scared the hell out of me, and this is probably inappropriate, but I can do this because you're not controlled by the FCC, I think.
That's correct.
But I often refer to President Obama as a black Jimmy Carter. And most people don't even understand what that means, but Jimmy Carter scared the hell out of me. I thought the world was going to hell in a handbasket when he was president, and I was just a young whippersnapper then, didn't really know what I was talking about. But there were two oil crises. I remember this significantly. The second one was much worse than the first one. And in the second oil crisis, the business of being a boat dealer turned into a disaster. And so the idea of being, by that time I'd become editor of Marine Business because the former editor had moved on to Inc. magazine. But when the second oil crisis hit, there was no hope for Marine Business magazine, and so we had to shut it down. And so that's my memory of the oil crisis. But, you know, that was after the second oil crisis that, you know, the powerboat companies were going out of business. The people that made motors for powerboats were going out of business. The sailing business kind of was okay because it's about sailing, not about gasoline. But but this was a magazine for boat dealers, and so half the boat business, this one out of business.
And then how did that lead to Inc., or were there a stop before Inc.?
So I worked at, I may have the dates wrong because it's so long ago, but I worked at Marine Business from 1977 to 79, and then we shut it down in 79, the former editor of Marine Business, who had hired me and taught me about editing, the first time I really had a mentor that taught me about how to write and edit, think about it, had been moved downstairs. I always think of it as downstairs, because Marine Business was on the second floor and Inc. was on the first floor. But he'd been moved downstairs to be the editor of Inc. magazine. So when we shut down Marine Business, he took on two of the seven employees that were laid off, me and the art director. And the art director moved in as the art director for Inc. magazine, and I moved down to be a features editor downstairs at Inc. magazine. And this is a separate anecdote, which I'll give you a little breathing room, but it was, you know, that was a much bigger operation. We had seven employees at Marine Business when it was shut down, and by then Inc. had like 20 or 22 editors.
And you mentioned, you wanted to note to me that it was in Inc. that you really got interested in entrepreneurs and in building businesses. Do you want to expand on that a little?
Yeah. So so I'm 62 now, in 2014. So in 1980, it's really late 79, so whatever it is, 35 years ago.
Right.
I really didn't know anything. I'm surprised by how little I knew at the time. I was, I guess, 26. I don't know if the math tapes up, but it was something like that. And I'm an English major, and I had done a couple of editing jobs and learned a little bit about editing, but I didn't really know anything about anything else. And so Marine Business, I started to learn about business and had some experiences with boat dealers and other companies. But I still wasn't really getting the whole business thing. And then I went to work at Inc. just randomly because it was published by the same company. And then I started to see business as a human experience. And that's really the big lesson I learned from Inc. is that starting business is not something you go to school for, although you can pick up some of the technical details. But if you're a businessman and if you're a successful businessman, it's a human thing. It's understanding your customers and suppliers and the people that work for you and being able to build something out of that. And it was the first time I began to gain insight into that. And it was also the time when the personal computer got started. So when I arrived at Inc. magazine in whatever year it was, 79, I think, that was when, after the Apple II had been introduced and before the IBM PC was introduced, and it was just the beginnings of a consumer computer business. So the combination of, you know, the excitement around computing and the idea that Inc. was the first magazine to sort of stand up and say that it was for people that started companies or entrepreneurs was an incredibly magical intersection. And you talked about being in the right place at the right time. That was just, I happened to be working for the company that started Inc. magazine at the same time the personal computer industry got started. So
you were also in the area that really had the fledgling companies, the first spreadsheet, and a lot of people don't realize that this didn't exist in the mainframe of the mini world. VisiCalc came out of Newton, Massachusetts, and with Bricklin and Frankston, and they formed Software Arts, and then eventually Lotus was formed out of there. So you were not only in the right place with the computer magazine, you were in the right place with the Boston Computer Society and with all those extremely bright people.
Yeah. I did transition out of that because I ultimately moved to the West Coast in 1983, and I saw what was going on the West Coast, which was way beyond what had happened in Boston. But in Boston at the time, we always thought of it as the hub. Boston was a college town of 32 colleges and, you know, this young population that was always trying to reinvent things and make something. And it had been the beginning center of technology where Digital Equipment Corp and Data General and these really fascinating companies got started. So you're absolutely right. In the beginning of the personal computer industry, what really happened there with it, that was the center of application development. The operating system and the machines were developed on the West Coast. Particularly Dan Bricklin, who had the insight that, you know, spreadsheet could be automated and programmed and even become a programming tool, which really Mitch Kapoor contributed through 123, was all developed in Boston. And it really was centered around the Boston Computer Society. So actually, Jonathan Rotenberg, who founded DCS, invited me to be on the board. And on that board were both Dan Bricklin and Mitch Kapoor. So I was really hanging out with that crowd. First while I was at Inc., and then I actually got fired from Inc., but that's another story. And then onwards.
For the benefit of the audience, Jonathan Rotenberg was a 14-year-old student when he formed the Boston Computer Society, and that became the biggest in the country. And it was and people from all of the software firms, as Stuart mentioned, the area were on it. And I remember them having conferences. And you go up to it, and it would be packed. And I was introduced to Jonathan's father, who was accomplished in his own right, but he was known by then as he was Jonathan's father. And Jonathan then went on to Brown, but he was a moving force in that whole area. His older brother Mark is a attorney and a professor at Georgetown, and also has been very active in the formation of privacy groups in the Washington
Mark,
area.
Mark Rotenberg, yeah.
Right, and it was just so interesting that he was able to bring together all these firms when he was 14, 15, and 16 years old. So.
Yeah, it was. He was a remarkable young gentleman. And there were stories about Jonathan when he had to travel. Apple invited him to go out to California to visit his Steve Jobs had kind of become enamored of the Boston Computer Society and of Jonathan, and they wanted him to come out and talk to him about this thing that he started called Apple Fest. They didn't know he was like, that would have been when he was about 17. They didn't know he had actually not yet graduated from high school because they'd never actually met him. He couldn't rent a car. So he had to figure out how to buy airplane tickets and get to California so he could meet with Steve Jobs, even though he didn't know how to rent a car, didn't have a credit card. So pretty funny time when things happen that, you know, you wouldn't normally expect to happen.
Another thing that we think of is Jobs as such a visionary, and he was. Jonathan had a story that after Steve spoke there, he was riding to the airport with Steve, and Steve said, "Boy, this is really great." He said, "You've got all this going on." He said, "But what are you going to do when everyone has computers and no one cares about this stuff?" And he was telling Steve, "No, no. If you put a word processing program into it, you know it's a word processor. But if you put a spreadsheet," he says, "and people are going to keep developing applications." And Steve not only bought that, he put it into his speeches as he went on. So then you went out of Inc., and then what happened?
So I tell people I've been fired three times, and Inc. was the first time. I keep saying it's long enough ago, but it's not as bad as it was when I had fired the other two times. It was a very gentle firing, but it was so I didn't have a job. You know, I was living in Boston and married and by then two kids, and so I was a little stressed out about what I should do, so I actually went to work at the Boston Computer Society, unpaid, But I became editor of the BCS magazine, and I redesigned it, and I spent about 9 months fantasizing that I could start a magazine, but I was still way too young, didn't know enough people, at least for my skill set. And so I ended up taking a job at IDG, and I want to note when I mention that Pat McGovern, the founder of IDG, just passed away about 3 weeks ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, at the age of 76. And, you know, I spent a total of 11 years working for that company that he started in several different guises, starting when I worked for a magazine that no longer exists that was at IDG. And I wanted to just note that that's kind of a historical passing because Pat, Uncle Pat, as a lot of people call him, really became an icon in the business, and particularly in the information part of the business. And
Pat wasn't known too much by people outside the industry, but he was well thought of in the industry. I know one of my oldest friends who passed away about a year and a half ago. I was my editor at a computer shopper, Stan Veit, who didn't work for Pat, but he always spoke so well of him. And when I ran across Pat and Lunar at at the Washington conference, I mentioned Stan to them, and they said how close they were with him. So it was interesting that within the industry, he was extremely well thought of, not like some other folks who did well but annoyed people.
Yeah. Now Pat was always a great guy. So anyway, I worked for a publication that was called, I can't even remember what it was called when I showed up, but the idea was that it wasn't doing very well. So they brought in outside talent, and I was the outside talent. And it was designed for what were then known as ISOs, or independent sales organizations, sort of to distinguish them from retailers. There was a publication called CRN, or Computer Reseller News, published by one of those other publishing organizations that you mentioned, and that was kind of dominant in the retail business and in the computing retail business. And so Pat had always wanted to have a publication in that domain, and he tried to sidestep CRM by going after more kind of integrators, and it didn't work very well because there's another publication that served them. And so they kept shifting this magazine around, and I was hired as the editor. So I went in and spruced up the magazine. I did something that IDG was major news, which was I was the first guy to introduce color printing at IDG. All of their prior publications had been printed like newspapers with black and white, and had never done color. So I revamped and got the magazine redesigned and started putting color covers and color pictures in it. And they thought that was just amazing that I was able to pull that off. So it was like it made me a superstar at IDG, that I was this fancy guy that had been at Ink Magazine and knew how to do color. And so that magazine did okay for a little while. We sold some advertising, made it bigger, did some, you know, fun editorial things. But it was kind of a boring audience and not much to say. And in 1983, Infowall blew up. The publisher and the editor were both fired. And I don't really know much about why that happened, although it did seem to happen on a regular basis there. And so they hired a new publisher guy, and he decided to hire me as the editor of InfoWorld. And so in August of 1983, it was a pretty quick decision. I think I decided in a week, bringing my wife and kids along with me, to move to California. And I've been here for 31 years now.
It was interesting. After we were at the Rosen conferences, and I called you up, and I wound up writing for them, and I did some reviews. Then Laurie Flynn, to later wound up at the New York Times, was the review editor. And I don't know if you were still there, but what was set up was we did an undercover operation in New York, going into computer stores as novices and asking questions. And at that time, the joke was that the difference between a computer salesman and a used car salesman was the used car salesman knew when he was lying.
Knew when he was lying, exactly, yeah.
And Barbara McMullen was treated as, because she was a woman, she had to be there gathering things for her boss, even though she was the secretary of the IBM User Group, which had at that time about 450 knowledgeable users, and she was one of the board in the Apple User Group. And I remember one of the stores telling her that a database program, the one that No, it's the fellow who got hurt in the skiing accident that time.
PFS file.
Yeah, PFS file. And she said, well, we need to be able to talk on the computer to have a computer communication. And the salesman told her the PFS file did that too. And so we wrote that up in InfoWorld. But then later, and you were out of there by then, I did a review of Adam Osborne's paperback spreadsheet, and it was not very good. And I wrote that, and the headline that the person put on it was whatever the name of the program was, doesn't compute. And there was some tweaking of the article that made it even worse. And I was away on vacation, and I got a call from my office to call Jonathan Sachs, who was the editor at that time, immediately. Yep. So I called him, and Adam had come in to complain. And he said it was all wrong, the article, and what was. So I sent the article off to Bricklin, who obviously knew something about spreadsheets. And he agreed that the article was fine. So I called Adam, and I pointed out that it had been edited and all this. But if you'd like, I would send him the original article as the way it was written, and I would talk to the editors about publishing the whole thing. And Adam said, "Nah, you killed it already. You know, it's not going to work." And but that and other chopping that they did on and a review that I did of the modem, of kind of soured our relationship. Then I was out of there too.
Yeah, well, I came back. That was much later. Famous one we did at that time was the. Let's see. Now I have to try to track back. Actually, we never really had any major blowups. I think we did a bad review of DOS at one point that Microsoft got all pissed off about. But InfoWorld was pretty well known for being tough in its reviews, and being independent. And so that was really the core value that I saw at InfoWorld, and tried to maintain while we dressed it up. InfoWorld was kind of, when I arrived in 1983, InfoWorld was more like a commune than a publication. They would have these meetings, these staff meetings, and much of the staff actually didn't bother wearing shoes or other forms of clothing that would be considered normal. And I came in as like this East Coast guy. I rolled in and I was telling everybody what to do. It did not sit well with the commune. I came in and August of, anyway, whether you go back to the whole thing. But I had people like John Markoff working for me and Lori Flynn, you mentioned. And there were some really great writers and technologists that worked for InfoWorld early on, and some of whom I hired, some of whom I inherited. Even though it was a pretty rough year that I was there, I was only there for 14 months. I had a lot of fun.
Well, I know that Jim Warren found it. I don't know if he sold it directly to ITG or if he sold it to someone else in the interim. And, of course, you have to remember...
He sold it to ITG. Pat bought it from Jim.
You also have to remember that Adam Osborne was in addition to being a sarcastic and a strong person in the industry at that time, he was also a fairly arrogant and dominant. And for him to show up in InfoWorld's office to complain about a review was a big deal at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he also started as a writer, if I remember correctly. Didn't he have a British accent, and he wrote about stuff before he started?
Yes, he was born in – there's an interesting background. He was born in Malaysia. His parents were anti-missionaries. They would go into places that had been converted to some form of Christianity and try to put the natives back to what they should have been. So that was fairly interesting. He wrote for McGraw-Hill, And he was, and he might have written for Interface Age, but he was very well known as a very intelligent, smart reviewer, and but always with a little poison in his reviews. Mm-hmm. And I guess when he was on the other side of it, he didn't like the poison quite as well. But I'll never forget at a Rosen conference, they gave away as a first prize. To a raffle, an Osborne won, and for the second prize, two Osborne ones. So I had one of the early Osbornes. So,
yeah.
So what happened after 14 months? Then where'd you go?
So, I was fired. That was the second time I was fired, and I was fired by the publisher, and I'm not even going to mention his name because I felt he was such a schmuck, and didn't want to associate that word with an individual. But he was wrong because he got fired about 3 months later. But they found out I wasn't the problem. But anyway, so I was sitting around and going to myself, literally going, "Well, this is the second time I've been fired. Being an editor kind of sucks because, you know, if anything goes wrong, you're the one that gets fired." So it's like not a lot of job security, and everybody else gets to say whether you're any good or not. So I decided to skip the whole job interview process and start my own business, and that was a newsletter called PC Letter, which I started in January of 1985. So I moved out in August of 83, got fired in November of 84, and turn around and start a newsletter in January of 85. And it was, since you remember the Rosen Electronics letter, after taking it over and turned it into Release 1.0, and most people don't know the first three letters in Release are REL, which is what the Rosen Electronic letter was. So it was a pun, Esther loved puns, and I should say loves puns. But so she called it Release 1.0 as an intimation that what Ben Rosen had been doing this sort of pre-release. I remember reading the Rosen Electronics letter when I first started to get involved in the business, and it was so much fun to read because it was really short snippets, and I even remember reading when he wrote it that VisiCalc, and I went back and looked at this, so it is a quote-unquote, that VisiCalc would be the tail that wagged the Apple dog.
The software tail that wagged hardware, that would wail hardware dogs.
Right.
One of the famous quotes in the industry.
Yeah, that people would start buying the Apple II in order to get the software, VisiCalc, which happened. In fact, it had a huge effect on Apple sales.
Oh, sure.
And he was right about that. He forecasted that. And I always thought that was kind of the model for newsletters. And what Esther did when she took it over was she made it much more of a thumbsucker, which you probably understand, but the idea that much longer pieces that would investigate a single topic in more depth, but sometimes were so obscure that normal people, including myself, couldn't understand what she was writing about. And I heard that complaint from a lot of people. So when I started my newsletter, I went to the library at the Boston Computer Society, and I can't remember if I physically borrowed or I certainly sat down and read like a couple of years worth of Rosen Electronics letters in a row just to kind of get a sense of, you know, what the pacing was and what he wrote about and how important things were and, you know, what the context was.
Yeah,
and
the Rosen letter started as the Morgan Stanley Electronics letter, and his first conference was at Morgan Stanley. Then he had one in New Orleans, and he went on to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And then one of the ones in Palm Springs was his, and then Esther took it over, I believe. But Ben's a very interesting guy. Ben is one of the only people that I know that his baseball trivia ranks with mine. And I'll never forget when a compact introduction, and Canyon was supposed to make it, and Canyon was late getting this, so Ben started. And Ben said, riding in today, I was looking through the sports pages. And today was the day that, I don't know how many years before, that Bob Henley pitched the greatest game of his career for the Chicago Cubs. He pitched a one-hitter. Unfortunately for Bob, he was pitching against Sandy Koufax, who stepped up and threw a no-hitter. And like Sandy Koufax, Compaq Computers steps up today. he was great at stuff like that.
Yeah. People go nuts about the companies today. I just need to do a little side trip here. They don't know that, you know, when Lotus Development went public or when Compaq went public, that people were made enormously rich and that there were exactly the same things that are going on right now when Opower goes public, or which happened on Friday, or when Twitter goes public. And the structure of it might be a little different and the scale might be different, but, you know, this is, I tell people, I've been going through bubbles every 3 or 4 years for the last 30 years, so why are you getting so weirded out by this particular bubble?
I remember one of the possibly the most famous quote ever from your newsletter, which I believe that you later backed off a little on, was that OS2 was a fascist operating system. How did that come about?
I don't think I ever said that, to be honest. But
it was attributed to you.
I might have said that. I was trying to communicate to people the difference between For a guy who didn't know anything about either business or technology, I did actually do a pretty deep dive and began to figure it out. And if you get into operating system design, it's a field of endeavor that's been going on for decades. People have been trying to design operating systems, and the operating systems that were developed in the PC era were not real operating systems. They started as, embedded systems originally, and then grew up and were able to deal with file systems, and all the different pieces of it were kind of tacked on and never designed from the beginning as a real operating system, a quote-unquote real operating system. Well, a real operating system is capable of doing some pretty magical things, and it, you know, needs a fair amount of memory space, and it needs all the input, output, and all the other pieces of the system to be able to produce that magic. Part of the problem is that in the early personal computers, whether it was Motorola-based chips or Intel-based chips or whatever it was, it just wasn't really very much memory, and the components were still being developed and we really had no idea. And so OS2 was really the first quote-unquote real operating system, and that was IBM's fundamental design objective, was to, produce a personal computer that had the properties of a real operating system. And of course, they're all twisted up because they're the major licensor of MS-DOS and Windows. But they also wanted to gain control back from Microsoft, and they felt that the right way to do that would be to design a quote-unquote real operating system. And so they basically used their history as a computer company to decide that, the way to compete with Microsoft was to really go to town in designing an operating system. And the sort of core of that design is an operating system that always is in control. And that is proper. It's, in fact, true, like in the Mac OS right now, that its roots, the Carnegie Mellon roots, I'm trying to remember what it was called originally, but when it was done at Carnegie Mellon, but the next operating system, which is really kind of the progenitor of the current Mac operating system, and, that is a real operating system, and it has a multitasking kernel, and it can do garbage collection, and I'm probably blowing half the people that are listening to this, but these are the things that a real operating system needs to do.
It was based on BSD Unix, the next, but they brought the graphic interface to it. The other thing that IBM tried to do then, if you remember, what they really wanted control back of was the hardware. They completely lost that to clone people and then to Compaq. Yeah. And they introduced the micro channel, thinking everyone would jump on it because there was a high-speed bus, and it was only when companies realized that they would have had to throw away all their old cards if they went to microchannel, that they kind of fell apart. But,
well, they were trying to combine, a real operating system with a real,
right.
real hardware design. And, if they broke it away completely. They might have been able to pull it off, but they're also still trying to maintain compatibility. And it was like, it was just a mess. Basically, there wasn't really anybody in charge, and this is what it always gets back to. This is why, you know, still today, I think that, you know, the competitive situation in any technology war goes back to who's providing leadership. And, you know, Steve Jobs is an unstoppable force because he had the, you know, I wouldn't even call it cojones. He just had the ability to say, well, this is the way it's going to be. And he would tell people what to do. He wouldn't wait for anybody else to agree with him. And, you know, if you look at the long-term decline of Microsoft, Steve Ballmer was willing to tell people what to do, but he didn't actually know what to do. And, you know, but if Jeff Bezos, you know, he knows what to do, and he doesn't wait for anybody to tell him what to do. And you know, I'm thinking maybe Larry Page has got that too. He seems to have the ability to tell people what to do. You know, in technology, you can't wait for a consensus to develop. You actually have to know what to do, and you have to do it fast in order to win. And IBM was the ultimate collective, where, you know, out of this whole process, they produced OS2 and Microchannel, and, you know, they felt this was the rational, logical way to do it, but it took them forever. And by the time it got out, it was like, well, just not good enough.
I was at the OS2 rollout, and I watched two companies just flame out then. At that time, if you remember, 123 was the dominant software product for 7 years. It was the spreadsheet, and WordPerfect was the leading word processor under MS-DOS. And they announced all of the companies to be supporting OS2, and they were up on the stage, and they had Jim Manzi from Lotus, and whoever the WordPerfect person was, and they had Paul Allen, who had done some work, and they were all talking about what they were committing to OS2 and an OS2 rollout. And then the question and answers, someone asked Gates, well, if you're this has the graphic user interface, and it has all these features, and it belongs to Microsoft, and other than the IBM Extended Edition, does that mean they'll be closing down your Windows development? And Gates said no. He said the Windows will be for the home user or the small business office. OS2 will be for mainstream business. And a little later, they asked Jim Manzi, who had never developed for Windows, obviously Lotus had done a very poor job with the Macintosh, that since now he was developing for a graphic user interface platform, would Lotus also be developing for Windows? And he said, and I remember this clearly, no. You heard Mr. Gates. He was talking about that'll be for individual home users. That's not our market. And that was game over.
Yeah. Well, game was over a long time before. A lot of people fail to distinguish between self-interest and consumer interest. Self-interest is a bunch of companies standing on stage slapping IBM on the back because they really want IBM to be successful in competing with Microsoft. Doesn't actually mean that people behave that way, that consumers will behave that way. It just means that's what they think at the time. So
Go ahead. Speaking of Microsoft, I've always favored the Macintosh and other platforms, although most of our consulting business has been to people using Wintel machines. But I've been extremely pleased with the Microsoft Surface, both the tablet and the computer. It's the best thing I've seen come out of the Microsoft since probably Microsoft Adventure. Well, Windows, I have to give it to Windows. Have you looked at the Surface?
Played with it. I'm really not a product guy anymore. I'm a gadget guy. I love playing with gadgets, but for Microsoft to be successful, and I give them full credit for trying, because they keep trying, and they keep rethinking the problem, the I don't even know what to call it now, but the tile interface, I don't know if they have a name for that, but they keep getting dinged for, you know, taking away the start button, and they're like hung on that petard, just just like they were with the command line on DOS. But the tile interface is clearly something that people recognize as being innovative and thoughtful and well-considered. And first they implemented it on phones, and then they tried to implement it on computers. And, you know, they tried to make computers both touch and keyboard-driven. So there's obviously a lot of smart people spending a lot of time thinking about this stuff, and, you know, that doesn't necessarily distinguish them from Google or Apple, because there are a lot of smart people at those companies, too. So it's not having smart people being well thoughtful and well considered that leads to success. So I don't really care whether Surface works well or not. And, you know, I'm a Mac user and an iOS user. I can tell you what's wrong with all that stuff, too. And I can tell you what's wrong with all of Google stuff. I can tell you what's wrong. All of this stuff is, you know, at some level, just it can't be perfect because it's changing too fast and they have to make decisions. There's some stuff about Microsoft that's just particularly irritating that it's still awful after all these years that they haven't gone back and fixed stuff they screwed up earlier, whereas Google and Apple seem to be able to fix stuff on a regular basis and surprise you with, you know, better stuff. But, you know, that's not really what matters. What matters, particularly in this environment, is, you know, Microsoft's going to have to, you know, they kind of lost this particular war. And, you know, you're not going to go reinvent search, and you're not going to go reinvent the Macintosh. And shoot, you're not going to go reinvent the mobile phone. In fact, you know, Google did a really good job of ripping it off. And it's amazing that Apple hasn't sued Google yet as they re-enter a trial with Samsung, but they're really using Samsung as a proxy for Google. So, you know, you can't, at the moment in time when you reinvent something and you think of it and how to make it much better and get it to the point where it's better enough that people are willing to change their behavior and adopt something new, you know, that's not the thing that anybody expects it to be. In fact, John, I can tell you, I know what the Apple television is going to look like, and I can give you the design specification for it, and I'm under non-disclosures, and I have no inside knowledge. And the reason I can tell you that is it's easy to figure out. It's not hard to figure out. In fact, Apple gave the model for how to figure it out with the phone, iPhone. So you just do to the television what the iPhone did to the cell phone, and you end up with a television that's designed in a radically different way that people will be much more pleased with. And I don't know why it's taken them so long to do it. I have my suspicions, but partially because Steve passed away along the way. But you know, it's not a hard thing to figure out. And so when you look at Microsoft and you look at Google, and you know, the other players, Amazon, we're not talking about hard stuff. It's not technically difficult. The hard part is having the understanding and the vision and the appreciation of consumers and the knowledge about the technology to be able to put that all together. So it's really interesting.
Well, I write a lot in the bookstore or in other places, and I and the Surface is the best thing that I've used for doing that because it has full Microsoft Office in it, and then I can put it up in the cloud, or I can put it on a USB. The people who have attacked Microsoft for Windows 8 and the tile interface, I think that a lot of people don't realize this is the first unique user interface that Microsoft has ever done. The command line interface goes around forever, and besides, they bought that product from Seattle Products, yeah, which came to MS-DOS. The windowing thing came out of Xerox PARC and through Apple to them. This is the first time they've done this, and it's not bad for a first shot, I think.
Yeah, and that can improve on it. The problem is they keep going back and forth. The real reason for the attack over Windows 8 is, you know, they tried to make up their minds so much that they got rid of the old interface. People that were used to the old interface are going, hey, what the hell? You took that away from us. We don't like this style thing. You know, they should have had like two product. I don't know what they should have done. It's a hard thing to pull off when you have that many people using one interface to try to get them to use a new one.
Well, users don't like change, and it's
users,
they like great things, but they don't often want to have to get there. I remember
they're more willing to accept it from new vendors, and that's one of the peculiarities of technology is that it's easier for a new company to introduce something new than for a company that already has customers.
You remember that techies, at the time that Windows finally got it right after the terrible Windows 1 and Windows 2, they hated Windows because, oh, I can do more at the command line, it's too inefficient. Windows really took off because of Mosaic. When all of a sudden there was a graphic web browser and you had to use either Macintosh or X Windows or Windows, then all of a sudden everyone wanted Windows in it. And
yeah.
It really took off.
And also it took them a while to really make Windows work.
But yeah.
That first Windows, you know, the very first Windows actually had a tiled interface. Windows 1.0 actually had a tiled interface. That's a lot of people.
But you couldn't
that.
Read it. You couldn't read text on the screen. The graphics was so bad.
Yeah, yeah, I know. That's because the machines weren't good enough to do a tiled interface, but they tried.
So what moved you from writing into venture capital?
Well, John, I'm sure you're not familiar with this, but I preferred to make money.
Oh, okay.
Okay. It's like, you know, I did a lot of work. I made people a lot of money. I made Pat McGovern a lot of money along the way. And then I had the experience of starting my newsletter and my conference, and I made a little bit of money from that. But, you know, after 20-plus years of being a journalist, being an editor, and a writer, you know, I kind of knew that business, and I've been doing it for a lot of, and had it well in hand. I wasn't feeling particularly challenged by it, and I wasn't really qualified for anything else, and everybody told me I didn't really need to know anything about money to be a venture capitalist, so I figured I'd take a shot at that, and NEA, New Enterprise Associates, is willing to take me on as a newbie and still make me a partner.
I always had to explain venture capitalists to my students who don't understand that number one, if you want a business, that you're going to have to go to these people, and it's heavy risk for them and almost none for you other than your life for a while. And would you explain for the general public exactly what venture capitalists do and how they do it?
Yeah, boy, that's a rough one. It's a very obscure business, so it's very hard to explain. And most people really aren't fundamentally interested in how it works at the level that, you know, any venture capitalist who's actually trying to make money from it understands it. So it is a really hard gap to cross. And I always like the airplane test. You know, if you're sitting next to somebody in an airplane, you explain to them what you do. And I've not successfully done that with venture capital. Even the statement that we're high-risk investors kind of falls on flat ears because, you know, nobody remembers all the stuff you lose money on in venture capital because you do invest in a portfolio, in other words, in a range of companies. And as long as you can find one that's successful, it has to be really successful. But if you find one that's successful, you still make money even if all the others lose money. The classic example of that being Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield Byers, number 9, you know, funds are numbered. And the 9th fund that Kleiner Perkins raised, I may have the numbers wrong, but the concept is right. Invested in 30 companies, might have been 32. I'm not privy to Kleiner Perkins' business, so this is all secondhand. And the 9th fund was raised in 1997 or 98, somewhere in there. So it was investing late in the bubble, the first internet bubble. And in 1999, they invested $12 million in Google. And as it turned out, every single other one in the portfolio failed or didn't make money. But Google made so much money that the investors in Kleiner Perkins 9 were extraordinarily happy because they made a lot of money. Every dollar they put in produced 20 or 30, all because of one company, meaning Google. And that's the perfect explanation of what a venture capitalist does because, you know, most people stop at the fact that they made Google, but you have to invest in 30 companies to find the Google. And you also have to suffer all the pain and suffering of investing in 29 companies that aren't that successful. And, you know, usually you have a few that are somewhat more successful than just losing everything. But you know, that's the risk, is it's not that because you're investing in a portfolio, you're not going to make money. It's that any one investment you make is likely to fail, more likely to fail than to succeed. And you have to design a strategy and know what you're doing to the degree that you can still make money, even though most of the companies you invest in lose. And this is the most sophisticated part of my understanding of venture capital now, means that at the time you're making the investment decision, when you don't really know what's going to happen and can't forecast it, that you have to actually take really big risks. And the only way you can do it is to, and Mark Andreessen and Andreessen Horowitz has written extensively about this, and clearly has practiced this, and Sequoia and others as well, that at the moment that you invest, when you don't know what's going to happen, you have to invest in something that seems crazy. So that's what it means to be a high-risk investor. It's not that, you know, you're risking the money. It's that you must risk the money. And there's a compulsion to risk the money, because if you don't put it at risk and you try to be safe, you'll end up not making enough money to stay in business.
I believe the Kleiner Perkins, where Venrock was one of the early Apple investors, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Arthur Rock, actually. Arthur Rock, personally. And I don't know if Venrock ended up being Arthur Rock's firm or if that's a different firm. I just don't know. But Arthur Rock himself was an investor at Apple.
Yeah. I did some consulting at firms that were underwritten by Rosen's firm, by Seven Rosen. And it was interesting to me at the time that, for instance, they invested in Ants that developed Paradox, and we did some consulting for what should the database be. And they had moved their person in as the president of the company, who had some business experience, which obviously the developers, who reminded me of Bricklin and Frankson, didn't have. And it was hands-on management, which I hadn't seen people do with either Apple or Lotus. So, do you get into that? Do you get into hands-on management of your investment?
Absolutely. You can't not. Part of what you're talking about is governance. Governance refers to the idea that there are people that should be overseeing the people that run the company. In a public company, this is a formal notion. In early stage investing, venture capital, it's an informal notion, but there is still governance. And that means that if you're going to go and invest in a company and spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to buy shares in that company, you have a responsibility to try to make the company successful, to serve all the communities in there, the shareholders, the employees, the customers. And so there is a requirement for being an investor in a company to pay attention and be actively involved. And then you can define active in many different ways. Some define it as going to the board meeting, which is a very lightweight definition of being actively involved. Truly actively involved means you have an opinion about how the company should be developing, and you're at some level arguing with everybody about that way that should happen, with the CEO, founders, with the other investors, if there are others. And the most active you can be is to actually become a manager of the company and to go in and start running the company. Generally speaking, it's not considered a good idea for investors to run companies, because otherwise they probably would have been executives rather than investors. And most people who are investors are really lousy at running things. You know, there's a bunch of truths about this, but the you know, this is all part of the mystery of venture capital. It's a pretty complicated thing, and there's no book. There's absolutely no book that you can read that tells you how to do it correctly.
And you talk about high risk, it sounds as though that your firm is primarily at the angel level, where you're working with people who have a couple of pieces of paper or the book,
yeah,
but they don't have any product yet.
Yeah, where we're, you know, I don't trust labels, so seed, angel, series A, all these terms have become, you know, vague and obscure now as we've gone by in time, so, but we like new companies. We've gone in a couple times to old companies and redefine them. That's just much, much harder to do, so we much prefer new companies. And we even come up with our own ideas and try to find people to start them. So we're right there at the beginning.
You and I have both been involved in technology for a long time, particularly when one considers the first working electronic computer came less than 70 years ago, and the first microcomputer system only 40 years ago. It seems to me that the two most important milestones in the microcomputer revolution with a spreadsheet, PhysiCalc in 1-2-3, that brought the computers into most business offices, and the graphic browsers, Mosaic and Navigator, that brought them into the home. What are your thoughts on how we got to where we are now?
I do have a historical perspective, and one that ties the past to the future. And I do tend to agree with John Doerr once said that, you know, the Internet was the greatest creation of wealth that mankind had ever experienced. I think that's what he said. That was the sentiment, at least. There's this tendency along the way, whether it's, you know, the personal computer, even going all the way back to the mini computer or the mainframe, that, you know, thing you're doing is the end line, end of the line, and there's a, you can see the beginning and you can kind of see the end of it. And it's the biggest mistake that people make because they can't see what new thing will start up after it. And new things keep starting up after it. So, you know, after the mainframe, the time-sharing computer started, and then after the time-sharing computer started, and the personal computer started, and then after the personal computer started, the network computer, the network came along, and, you know, now everybody's talking about devices, connected devices, and how we're going to have them all over the house, and a bunch of other things too, drones, and other big ideas. So I think... You know, and I'm, as I mentioned earlier, I'm 62, so I've had almost 40 years in this business now. I don't think I'm going to see the end of it. Whenever I might expire will be before that happens. So to say there's never an end to it. And so I think there started a natural progression, really, after World War II when the transistor was invented and then everything after that, that started then and is leading us into a new world. And we don't really know what that new world is going to look like. What we're experiencing right now is that new world, whatever it might end up being like, is changing the way that we live our lives in pretty dramatic ways, the way we talk to each other. In fact, you know, you're doing a radio show that's actually on the Internet. I don't know if you're doing any broadcast here, but, you know, that's a change right there, the way that we're doing this. And if you take that kind of perspective, if you say the transistor was the beginning in the, you know, early computing days in the, say, 1950, just to pick a date, and that's now 2014, that's like coming up on 65 years. And if we're halfway, you know, we've got another 65 years to go before whatever the thing that might be at the end of this is, and maybe it's a cataclysm and we all go out of existence or whatever. But and there is a sense that we've been accelerating all along the way, so that developments now, I was talking to this to somebody else recently, where it used to be a change happens in generations, or in times bigger than a generation, so that a generation could kind of live their lives without, you know, the world changing on them, or without changing more than once. But the speed of change is now happening to the point where change is happening, significant change is happening multiple times within a generation. And so the skill set's now being developed to surf change. And, you know, at the age of 62, for me to have gone through as many changes as I've had to go through, you know, and I'm sure you'll remember this. I remember when I started in Inc., I smoked 3 packs a day to the point where I'd be, but I have this visual image in my head of sitting in front of an IBM Selectric typewriter, pre-correcting key, smoking, picking up the telephone and cradling the handset in my shoulder and dialing with one hand while I'm still typing with the other hand and a cigarette hanging out of my mouth. Well, you compare that to what I'm doing right now, actually, looking at my computer. I actually just sent you an email and talking to you and your audience, and, you know, here we are. So I think the last 30 years from the personal computer forward, what we've got is that, well, this stuff accelerates. I don't know what the next thing is. How does it accelerate from here? That might have been excessively philosophical, but I thought I'd take up that.
No, I want to keep jumping in. By the way, at that time, both Barbara and I were smoking 3.5 packs a day. Thank God we haven't for 32 years.
Yeah, no. So it's 1987 for me. August 6th, 1987, the last day I smoked a cigarette.
I've written a lot on what I call creative disruption and how technology keeps changing everything, often under the radar, until we notice that there are no more music or film stores in the mall or enable loses his job because of technology innovation. My latest, which is the 104th column in the series, is about possible changes to the internet as we know it. What impact do you see of either or both the movement away from net neutrality or the possible international agency taking over the internet naming and numbering function that's always been controlled in the U.S.?
Okay, well, this is going to be a little bit, I'll go on a bit of a round trip here, but, you know, I grew up in the Cold War, and the Cold War was an exquisite balance of power, with both sides believing the other side could obliterate them at any minute. And, you know, we had this concept of mutually assured destruction. This is accelerating world history, but, you know, then Reagan came along and, you know, whether he did it on purpose or not, subsequently the Soviet Socialist Republic shattered and collapsed. And we then entered a period where in the world as we know it, we, the Americans, are an untrammeled power. No one can match our power. And we as Americans sit around and go, but we're Americans. We're the good guys. Why is everybody up so upset? And everybody else sits around and goes, holy Christ, they're Americans. They could just enter our country any time and take us over, which we've done a few times. And what we don't realize as Americans is we scare the hell out of everybody else. And we still don't get that. We still don't really understand what that means. We'd rather not. We'd like to be the nice guys. And we live in a world where, you know, we don't have any existential threats. So it's so we don't really understand the idea of those threats that scare everybody else and how they attach that in their head. So this is a sort of global political situation. Having us control the internet, I don't think is a good idea. So this is why I'm coming around to it. I don't think it's any better having us control the internet as having an untrammeled military power. I think we have to find a way to have the internet controlled by some kind of international body. Now, whether what's been proposed is the right way, God knows. I don't. You know, there is really no international power. There was a period of time when George Bush was trying to dismantle the United Nations, so for good reason, because it's pretty much a feckless organization that hasn't done any good for anybody since it was formed, whatever, 60 years ago. So there's no real, that I know of, there's no real model for how you successfully do something with an international body. So I've just posited both sides of the problem.
some of the concerns there, though, is that the agency, the people that are talking about this telecommunications agency, last year passed something that they accepted that at times countries would have to either disable the entire internet within their country or cut off some people to ensure that there wasn't total chaos. Now, we know that China does that, and obviously Putin did it during the Ukraine, but the feeling is that once you establish that as the right, that just opens the door, and for us to get involved with an organization like that, or to get involved with people like the French who have said previously that we have this too much of a concern for this free speech, and obviously they don't mean it as bad as it sounds, but they do mean that we shouldn't let people tell people how to make bombs on the internet or whatever, and which the First Amendment has always given people the right to, as long as you don't blow up anybody. It seems to me that there is some realistic concern for turning over that kind of regulation. Now, I don't see any problem with turning over naming and numbering, but people seem concerned, the Wall Street Journal is concerned that that's the first step.
So, yeah, this is probably above my pay grade.
Okay.
I'm thinking about Turkey. Gee, if you have an international body that, manages the internet, do they get to tell Turkey they can't block Twitter? Can't block DNS? Whoa, if you can tell Turkey that, then what the hell do you do about the Chinese? Anyway, so I think this is above my pay grade. Mm-hmm. It's actually, and I think it's bigger than the internet. I think it's a function of how we get to a true kind of federation, birth federation, if you will, about how we run ourselves as a planet. I don't think we're ready for that yet, and I think that's going to be decades away.
What about net neutrality, where we now have Netflix and Apple cutting deals with Comcast to ensure that if there's any problem on the net and delays, that they get higher priority than you or I, which is the first of really the end of net neutrality. How do you feel about that?
I think net neutrality is a fantasy and it's not real. So, yeah, and what Apple and Netflix are trying to do is guarantee they can get a movie delivered without any jitter on it. That's actually a pretty practical desire to want to be able to deliver movies, which they do. That's part of their business. I bought iTunes and Netflix and now Amazon to some degree and Google. All are in the business of delivering movies, streaming media. You kind of want those movies to actually work when you deliver them, and consumers are happy with that. So the deals they're striking actually don't really have a lot to do with net neutrality. It's much more about quality of service. Net neutrality doesn't guarantee that everybody gets the same quality of service, only guarantees that everybody gets access. Right now, so I'm sitting here looking at an Aris modem. It's plugged into Comcast, and the lights on my Aris modem are blinking at me. They've been blinking at me for days. I have no idea why they're blinking at me, but Comcast is my only option. On that cable. I have no other option for how to get internet service on that cable. So they have an effective monopoly on my cable. And sure, the phone lines, there's more of a competitive situation there, but my only option right now for service on my phone line is AT&T. There's no one else here capable of providing service on that line. And I think, if you're going to guarantee real net neutrality, you would define an interface. And I don't know exactly how to do this, that, anybody could plug into it. And the government has just really not stepped up to guaranteeing a fair playing field. The government's job is to guarantee a fair playing field, not a result, right? So their job is not to guarantee that everybody gets it for $19.95 or $17.95 a month. Their job is to make sure that everybody gets it and that the rules are well understood and that everybody competes on the same rules. Comcast is not competing on the same rules as everybody else. They've got a wire stuck in the side of my house that they control, and they've abused that. And you can go look at all the jokes about Comcast service. They've abused that to their benefit, repeatedly over decades, and the government hasn't done anything about it. So, you know, I'm a pretty conservative guy, and I tend to agree with Wall Street Journal editorials, but I don't think net neutrality is a reality right now anyway.
Yeah, I have, in my county, the only the only cable company with access is Cablevision. And it was only within the last 5 years that the town, which has given total monopoly to them, they opened it up to competition to Verizon Fios. So we have one phone company, and we have one and we have one cable company, period.
Right. So this is the thing to understand, John, is that the regulation of Internet access is regulated in the telephone infrastructure by a single national entity, i.e. the Federal Communications Commission, but on the cable infrastructure is regulated locally, and that
right.
monopoly is granted. So the city of San Francisco grants Comcast monopoly on cable service within the city limits of San Francisco, and in return, Comcast pays the city millions of dollars. It's a very interesting situation. Why hasn't anybody ever investigated the relationship between the fees paid to municipalities by the cable companies and their ability to maintain a monopoly? Seems like a pretty clear quid pro quo, but that's not equal access. And so, you know, that's a tough problem for San Francisco to lose those millions of dollars. It would have severe impact on its ability to operate. But, you know, it's very highly beholden to Comcast, and yours is beholden to whatever one you mentioned.
Cablevision and Verizon,
So now, what's really fascinating to watch is Google swimming around establishing fiber to the home, which is really, really rocking. People have actually moved to Kansas City to get fiber to their home. And they are also making payments to the municipality, and they're running around, and they're all doing it very visibly, so you can't say that they're bribing people or anything. It's not an illegal thing. You're playing by the rules, but they're using their immense financial power. And if Comcast has anybody to worry about, you know, Google's going to come along and stick an even better wire in people's house, and then people are going to go, oh, I want Google's wire instead of Comcast or AT&T's or Verizon's wire. Now, Verizon's wire is pretty good, too, because Fios is fiber to the home, but the way they're installing it is through the telecoms infrastructure, and it's way more expensive than the way Google's doing it. Google can get fiber to the home much cheaper than Verizon can. It's all
right.
Very fascinating. It's a little out of our control, but, you know, you kind of want the people in the government. And what's his name, Janachowski, who was running the FCC for Obama, I think, kind of went out and never really dealt with this stuff. You know, he claimed net neutrality and all this stuff, but he didn't get at the underlying issues of, you know, local monopolies and exchange of money.
There are many other innovations progressing along, such as 3D printing and the one you mentioned earlier, Internet of Things, which Cisco's John Chambers is touting as the next big thing. What's your reading on the current impact of these technologies, and what else should we be watching that may have major impact on our lives?
Well, the Internet of Things is kind of also a fantasy, and it's a great slide. And it's not just John Chambers. General Electric has this thing called the Industrial Internet, which is, it's not just these guys standing up and touting them. It's actually people really interested in stuff. You know, the fact that your smartphone that you carry around with you packs like somewhere between 6 and 9 major sensors on it is really interesting. And, you know, that you can get a digital lock that you can hand out electronic keys with, and, you know, on and on and on. There's a lot of really interesting stuff going on, and people are really fascinated by the possibilities that, because hardware is the new software and components are so small. I've got my desk, which I'm sitting at right now, is littered with Pebble Watch and a Shine wearable and got all this stuff I've been buying trying to figure it out. Most of it doesn't work very well, but that's kind of the nature of things. The Internet of Things is a phrase that's been made up. It's caught a little bit of people's imagination, but most of these things actually aren't on the Internet. Don't have an IP address. Instead, they're connected to your local network, and there's going to be a boatload of stuff that comes out that doesn't work with each other, and it's going to be at some point a backlash against stuff.
What about 3D printing?
Now, 3D printing is a really that's very interesting. Again, there is this conflict between being interesting and actually working. Things are much more interesting before you have to figure out how to make them work. It's been true in the computer industry all along. So 3D printing right now kind of sucks. The 3D printers themselves just barely work. You know, their ability to register and produce an object is still limited unless you spend a lot of money. And the ability to operate a 3D printer is still requires a lot of tedious. How do you find the files? How do you get the files onto the printer? How do you command the printer? These are all still issues that need to be worked out, and these are pretty fundamental issues. But if you start going down the path of, gee, you can make one off of something, a lot of the Internet of Things devices that we're talking about have the prototypes were 3D printed, or components of the prototypes are 3D printed and stuck together. So right now there's actually a directly relevant effect in your ability to develop prototypes and do short-run manufacturing using 3D printers in order to develop new products. But that's just the beginning. And where it ultimately leads is that you have an integrated, distributed manufacturing system that, you know, for any particular set of units of a product that you need to make from one to a million, there's a kind of graduated system where you can get one made locally, or you can get 10 made locally, and you can do it from your computer and push the big red button and so on and so forth. So that's where it really gets interesting, because it implies that the entire system for manufacturing products is going to change over the next 20 or 30 years to the point where it's completely different. And it might be that, you know, the United States of America once again becomes a manufacturing powerhouse, because you don't need all those people making stuff. And this is a broad spectrum topic that you can spend hours on, but that's what makes it interesting.
And the big brother of 3D printing is the nanotechnology that Eric Drexler has been pushing for years, about making things in your home through your Star Trek type device.
Bio devices where, you know, you're really using organic chemistry to create new functions. But yeah, all right. Blah, blah.
And you know, to me, on items of interest to you, you mentioned the politics of technology. Would you expand on that a little? What do you mean by the term, and why is it important?
As I kind of said this before, people assume that the way things are is the way they will be. And there used to be the Wintel Alliance, which was, you know, Windows, Microsoft, and Intel, you know, produced most of what was going on in computing, and Apple got locked out, and kind of the way things were, that was the politics of the personal computer. Microsoft and Intel aren't necessarily the ones making stuff happen anymore, and so now it's other things are making stuff happen, and, you know, now there's various guesses about who the powers are, but, gee, Apple's one of the powers, Google's one of the powers, Amazon's one of the powers, and Samsung, kind of, although you can find holes in that part of the story. So Samsung's really not part of the politics, and the politics are...
You have to throw Facebook in there, I think, too.
Yeah, I know. People throw Facebook in there, but I'm still not totally sold on that.
A billion clients, they've got heavy weight.
And who can get distracted. Great conversation to have with people right now. Gee, how much do you use Facebook now, and what do you use it for? And, you know, what's going on there? Are there shifts going on in how people use Facebook? They're making so much money off me on mobile phones right now that I look at the mobile client and I go, this is more about making Facebook money than it is about me using Facebook to connect with my friends. Anyway, that's another topic. So I'm still not sure that Facebook belongs there more, because... you could say that Facebook is the China of technology politics, because China doesn't totally sign up for being a political entity. You know, kind of play by the rules, right? They're off there, and they have a billion people too. So I like that analogy. I just came up with it. Facebook is the China of technology politics. But the ones who do play the game are Google, Amazon, and Apple, and the wannabes, Microsoft and others. The the politics of technology are really about kind of who's deciding what's true. And I love the fact that Bill Gates spent decades running Microsoft, terrified that Microsoft would be sidelined by some new development. And he was right. It's amazing. You know, he was right. He was so smart that he was right about the thing to worry about. He just couldn't figure out how to stop it from happening. And so what I mean by being fascinated is it means always, always, no matter what's going on, somebody new can come along and change the playing game, the playing field. And Google did it most recently. Apple did it. And Google and Apple did it most recently. Apple was almost out of business, and Google was this kind of, you know, weird, it's hard to characterize the early Google, but, and so, you know, the fascinating thing is always to look at the outside and see who can come in and disrupt that political landscape.
Yeah, it's interesting how that I remember in my Wall Street days, the companies that were the big service companies, they were using IBM mainframes, ADP, and a company that I did some consulting with. And all of a sudden, when the new guys could come along with Supermicros using DB2, they could do the same thing so much cheaper. And it was very difficult for a company to do. We start all new development with all of the money that we have invested in our COBOL big computer processing, or do we ride it out and see what happens? And companies that have a lot invested in a particular technology, a particular software, find it very difficult to compete with the person that doesn't have to make those decisions, you know?
Yeah. That's why I love venture capital. There's always a chance we can come up with the next major power. Just about a little bit self-aggrandizing, but our hottest company right now is a company called Twitch, twitch.tv. Twitch, you know, on the face of it, is a way to let people watch people playing video games, which, you know, you just sit there and think about what I just said and go, why would you want to watch people playing video games? Don't you want to play them yourself? Well, video games have actually become a professional sport, and there are people that make a full-time living from playing video games. And then there are teams of those people, and there are leagues of those teams. And so it's, you know, you sit there and you try to imagine, wow, how did that ever happen?
Do you need to be a subscriber to World of Warcraft or something to watch people, or is this outside of that?
No.
Is it different?
Free to watch. You can watch people playing World of Warcraft or League of Legends or Call of Duty 2 or, you know, the what Twitch is, you just go to twitch.tv, you can see somebody who's playing it right now. If I go look at it, Twitch.
Q-U-Y-C-K or Q-U-Y-K?
It's just like you'd spell Twitch, twitch.tv. There's a broadcast going on where people are, there's a thing called the Texas Showdown, Day 3. Two guys that are talking about, and there's a guy doing a floor report. Oh, my God. Here, I should turn this off so it doesn't create background noise. But so there are actual tournaments. So there are people broadcasting from the tournaments. But between the tournaments, you go there and you see somebody's screen, and they're doing a voiceover on the game that they're playing. There's a chat window about what game they're playing and people chatting about how well they're playing and what else they could be doing, a bunch of other stuff. So it's,
and is it sideline reported like in the NFL? Wow.
Yeah. When you say like NFL, we're not talking billions of dollars yet, but, you know.
No, but in the NFL, in addition to the broadcasters, you have sideline people.
Yeah, sideline. That's why I said down on the floor, because in these tournaments, there's a lot of computers down on the floor where people are playing video games and they're matched against each other. Maybe more appropriately, like a chess tournament or a poker tournament. Twitch does kind of 45 million viewers a month. And the number that's really amazing is it's about 5 million people a day spend an hour and a half to 2 hours a day on Twitch.
Wow.
So this is a new activity. This is a very modern activity. obviously, you know, we started the decades ago, but video games have been part of the cultural phenomenon now. And so, you know, who would have ever expected this? When we invested in the company, actually, we weren't thinking that's what was going to end up happening with the company. We're perfectly happy that it has, because the company's become very valuable and we'll make a lot of money off it. But that's why I love venture capital. It's like we get to stand out on the edge and find stuff that's going to become important in the future.
Ben, you're talking about the speed of innovation. This, of course, is Ray Kurzweil's big idea, and he keeps talking about how by 2030 that we'll be downloading brains to chips and everything. So, you know, so there are people talking about how he just keeps going faster and faster and faster and faster and faster.
And yeah, it's all right, too. It's all true.
Yeah. Well, we've covered a lot of bases in exploring your life and your thoughts. What else would you like the audience to know about Stuart Elsa?
You probably pretty much got all of it. The only thing I do when I'm not doing this is hang out with my grandson and go fishing.
Well, that's good. You have the time to. That's terrific.
Yeah. Not enough. But that's actually, John, what I'm going to go out and do is have dinner with my grandson and his mother, who happens to also be my daughter, and my other daughter. And we're all going to go have dinner. So I do have to sign off at some point.
Well, we can do it now. Thank you, Stu. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Great, John. Thank you.
And in the words of Met Radio announcer Howie Rose, after a Mets win, put it in a book. Tune in next week for my conversation with Bob Tendy. And as they said in the old neighborhood, see ya. And steady, Silva. Steady. Here we go. We'll be right back.